You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And with me today is an individual who spent his entire life producing impact on a massive scale. He is currently a distinguished professor of the practice in Georgetown University's McDonough Business School, where he started and oversees the Business for Impact Center and is the co-founder of Porter Novelli, one of the first social marketing companies. And now it's a global public relations agency. He is formerly the CEO of AARP, that's the American Association of Retired People, the president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and was also the COO, Chief Operating Officer, of CARE USA. He is the co-author of 50 Plus, Give Meaning and Purpose to the Best Time of Your Life, Managing the Older Worker, How to Prepare for the New Organizational Order, and editor of A Roadmap for Success, Transforming Advanced Illness Care in America. His new book will be out in February. It's called Good Business, The Talk, Fight, Win, Way to Change the World by my guest and my friend, Bill Novelli. How are you, Bill?
Art, I'm fine. I'm really fine. And I want to thank you for that really gracious introduction.
Well, it's just my real honor to have you here today, Bill, and to be able to spend this time with you. Over the last dozen or so years, we've had many occasions to sit and chat and talk about the great work you're doing. And it's now going to be wonderful to share what you've done in your life and what you're currently doing with a much wider audience through this podcast. And you are truly the heart of giving, my friend. So audience, fasten your seatbelts. You're in for quite a ride here. Bill, let me start the interview off by just getting a little bit about Bill, the young boy growing up as you did, and how did that sort of transition you into your career?
Well, Art, I was a very lucky kid, I think. I grew up in a blue-collar town near Pittsburgh. A wonderful family, and we had what I called immigrant values. So my parents weren't immigrants, but my grandparents were, and they lived not far from us. And those immigrant values that I think of are, I think, the same kinds of values that we want to impart to our kids and our grandkids today. A real love of country, an appetite for hard work, a reverence for education, all the things that you and I and our society should stand for.
Well, that's so true. And it's made this country the power that it is, those values that you just expressed. Bill, when I think about impact, I can't help but think about the work that you've done. And we're going to get into that as we talk through this interview. But you've headed some of the most, I would say, successful organizations and campaigns that we've seen in the country. I'm sure a lot of our guests would also want to know how it was that you transitioned from a life of business to one of social impact. Talk to us a bit about what it was that drove you to leave a public relations firm that you helped found to creating actually an organization for good and doing all of the great work that you've done that we're going to talk about.
Well, I can tell you, Art, it was not a straight line. It took me a while to figure it out. So as you say, I started in business. I was a marketing manager at Unilever. and I was doing well. And then I went to a hot New York ad agency on Madison Avenue. And these were back in the days when Madison Avenue was hot, you know, the Mad Men era. And I was doing well there also. But I had a problem. And my problem was I couldn't find any, what I was thinking of as social relevance in my work. Mm. I was marketing kids' cereals, cat food, dog food, hair groom, no heavy lifting. I had a young family, but it just wasn't doing it for me. And then one of the stories I like to tell is I came back from a client meeting, and I had been working with the client on a new kid cereal and a new dog food. And this young copywriter came into my office and he said, "Hey, we're doing some concept statements for that new kid cereal. Do you have any samples?" And Art, I reached into my briefcase and I took out the dog food. And I threw it across the room. I said, "Yeah, here." And he caught it and he said, yeah, we can sell that. And I said to myself, it's time, bro. It's time to change.
We can sell that.
And I don't mean to denigrate business and industry. I've spent half my life in the private sector. But from there, I found my way. I went to the Peace Corps. I didn't go to Mozambique or Colombia. I helped to market the Peace Corps from Washington, D.C. Mm. And Art, these were the days when these host countries, they loved the Peace Corps just as they do today. But they wanted more volunteers with agricultural experience, more nurses, more MBAs, older volunteers, and especially they wanted people who looked like them. So my job was to try to reposition the Peace Corps to attract those kinds of volunteers.
Interesting. What kind of success did you have there? What did you find when you got there? And what would you say it was like after you left?
Well, I think that the Peace Corps has been a huge success. I like to think I made a small contribution to it. But let me give you some examples. I did a lot of consumer research. And one of the things I found was that people said that they personally knew a Peace Corps volunteer. And I did the math and I thought, you know, at that point, there had only been about 10,000 returned Peace Corps volunteers. There was no way that all these people could personally know a volunteer. And my conclusion was that they wanted to know a volunteer. They were proud of the Peace Corps. And I think that's exactly the way it is today. And another thing I learned, Art, from doing this research was I did a lot of surveying among returned volunteers. And I said, "What is your biggest concern? What keeps you up at night?" And the most common answer was, "I'm afraid that the sand is going to blow over my tracks. And all that work I did in that developing country is going to disappear and I'm going to be forgotten." And I thought that was really powerful. And you know, Art, it's true today. Not just the Peace Corps, but how do we create social change that's going to last? You know, generations grow up, budgets change, the environment changes. It's not easy to do something that's sustainable.
Well, you know, that's so true. My daughter, by the way, my daughter Jessica was in the Peace Corps and she spent a couple of years in Guatemala. And we often talk about her experience, which was formative for her. But she will say, and I will agree, that she got about as much out of the Peace Corps as she put in. That experience really helped her become the lady that she is. And I know the same is probably true for so many who've entered and gone through that experience. We're great, I think, as a nation for having such a program that can position young people to move around the world and contribute. But I think it also adds so much to what we're able to do as individuals who actually go through that experience. So kudos to you for giving what you could to that organization and generating some of the insight that they could use to recruit people like my daughter.
You know, I was just going to say, Art, that I really respect Peace Corps volunteers. And I'm sure she got as much out of it as she put into it. And of course, that is the beauty of the Peace Corps. And then I went on, as you say, to start a company. And back in those days, I guess my partner and I, his name was Jack Porter, we were a little bit naive. You know, we said, well, let's start a company applying marketing and marketing communications which was what we knew, to what Washington is all about. And we thought Washington was about health and social issues. And you and I know it's about power and politics and money and maybe sex.
Yeah.
But we didn't know that. Yeah. We were naive, and it worked out for us. And we ended up, you know, really pioneering in social marketing.
Do you recall who your first client was? That would be fascinating.
I do. Yeah, no, I do. Our first client was the National High Blood Pressure Education Program, and it was out of NIH. And it ended up being one of the most successful public education programs in America. And we learned a lot from that. I like to think we contributed a lot as well.
Well, I mentioned in one of my previous podcasts, I had Nancy Brown with me on a podcast. Nancy's the CEO of the American Heart Association. And I mentioned in that podcast that as a 19-year-old, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure. And it was because of, you know, lifestyle and medication and information, really, that I've been able to lead a relatively healthy life and to get to 62 years old. But about the time you had entered that work, lots of people were dying very young because of high blood pressure. So again, you know, here you go. One of the most important things we could do was get information. And here you were right in the middle of that.
Well, I was really proud of it. And, you know, Nancy is one of my favorite people. She is such a leader. And back in that program on high blood pressure, the American Heart Association was a key player.
Not surprising. Not surprising at all. Well, you had some other opportunities to work with the American Heart Association later on. We'll get to that a bit. But getting back into your business, the Portinovelli firm, which, by the way, after you left, our business actually did some business with. The Wise Giving Alliance was a client of Portinovelli.
Oh.
And they did terrific work for us, by the way. But I wanted to just sort of ask you, you know, you're going along in this business and you're now discovering that you can create social impact through, you know, your talent of marketing and communications. And you're growing this firm at the same time. At what point did you sort of say to yourself, maybe there are some other pathways for me aside from this successful business?
Well, you know, the business had many, many social and health clients, but that was not all we had. We had a lot of corporate clients as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I reached a point after our firm and several others merged together into a big holding company of marketing communication agencies. It's called Omnicom.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, I like the social side of this. I like the social impact part of it. I'm going to go back and make that the mainstay of my career. And so it took a little bit of courage, I guess. I have a wonderful wife who encourages me along the way. And so I left. I left the firm with my name on the door. And I went across town. This was in Manhattan. And I joined CARE. And I had been on the board of CARE, and I loved their mission, and I've always been mission-oriented. So I went to CARE, which was doing terrific work in about 40 developing countries with a whole bunch of grown-up Peace Corps volunteers, and I tackled it. And it was another really terrific experience for me.
What are some of your memories over at CARE? And by the way, the first podcast, we had Dr. Helene Gale.
Ah.
On the show. And as you know, she was the CEO of CARE for about 9 years. But we had so many other things to talk about that we didn't get to talk about her experience at CARE. But it'll be great to hear you talk about that old world.
Well, she was a great leader at CARE. I was before her. And when you say, what are some of my experiences? One of the most powerful ones was whenever the Rwanda genocide occurred. There was a huge refugee camp set up in Tanzania. And a lot of these Rwandans escaped into Tanzania and ended up in that refugee camp. And I was there with my CARE buddies. I had come in from headquarters, as we called it, and helped to negotiate with the UN. And I'll tell you what, Art, I have never seen anything like it in my life, and I don't think I ever will again. It was an enormous camp. There was probably room for 200,000 people. And when I left, there were probably 350 or 400,000. And when you flew over that camp, you could see the widening circles as the women and children went out and collected firewood and whatever else they could get to bring back to the camp. And you know, today, Art, it's actually worse. There are more displaced people in this world than there were back then. And every day, I'm thankful. I'm thankful for having seen that and having the opportunity to do something about it.
Wow. You know, people don't often get to envision what others are going through, even as we deal with this pandemic and the enormous challenge and, I would say, inconvenience that it is placed on many of our lives. We still have it so much better here in the United States than most people do in other countries, particularly ones like you mentioned. And I often think that as we go through these difficult moments, Bill, that we should somehow remember that as bad as we think it is, our lives could be so much worse. And if that means that we have to go through a little bit of change or a little bit of difficulty, a little bit of challenge, we'll get through it. And no matter what happens, we'll probably come out better than most people in the underdeveloped world. And sometimes it's not just the aspirations that should drive us forward. It's the fundamental understanding that our lives are just so much better and just being thankful, particularly, you know, for the lifestyle that we have and for the opportunities that we have here in the United States. You obviously saw that firsthand. You had a chance to experience that both with your experience at the Peace Corps and CARE. And so then you decide you want to move again, and this time to sort of take on some work, I believe, at AARP, which is synonymous with aging well in the United States. How did you come to join AARP? What was it that connected you with that work?
That's a good question. Before I get to it, though, I want to say that you sound to me like an optimist. And I really share that philosophy. I do think that we're in a great country. We've had our ups and downs, but optimism is exactly how I feel. And, you know, you talked at the beginning of the program about this book that I've done, and I like to think it's full of optimism. After CARE, before I went to AARP, I started the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Mm. And I took my lumps fighting in the tobacco war and made some real progress, not by myself, of course, but just really taking on the tobacco industry and giving kids a chance to really see that they didn't really have to be smokers. So I did that and fought that fight, got beat up a little bit, and then I went on to AARP. And I went to AARP, Art, for some basic reasons. Number one, I really liked their mission. Once again, a mission. And they had been my client at Porto Novelli, and I knew their mission was about enhancing the quality of life for all as we age. So it wasn't just about older people. It was intergenerational.
Well, let's talk for a minute first about this beating that you took with the tobacco-free kids. Because I will say to people that this could be one of the most successful campaigns in the history of social impact. Because getting people to not smoke or to think differently about the problems associated with smoking had to be, you know, just an enormous challenge. And yet it was one that I think we kind of won. I mean, people ask me about some of the biggest challenges in the world, and I usually will compare it to the campaign that you all waged to get us somewhat off of cigarettes. I can't think of anything more challenging than that, because you have not only the habit of smoking, which a lot of people enjoyed, but the marketing around it, and as well as the addictive nature of tobacco that you were fighting. How were you able to achieve impact? What were some of the things you were doing? And in the end, you started at one place. Where did we actually end up in your estimation?
You're absolutely right about tobacco. I mean, that's one of the greatest challenges there is. You know, it took 50 years to figure out how to basically curb tobacco. And what it finally took, Art, was four basic strategies. Number one, raise the price. So we raised the price. We succeeded in getting the price up at the federal level and at state levels. And when you raise the price, consumption goes down, especially among kids, but also adults. The second thing was we had to persuade kids not to experiment, not to get addicted. Most people do get addicted before they're 18 years old. And so we worked very hard on that. And there were some really great creative ideas that came out of all that work. And then we had to help adults quit. And you probably know from the people you know that it's really, really hard to quit an addictive habit like that. And it takes 4 or 5 or 6 times before adults succeed. So we had to work on that. And then finally, just as you said, we had to get legislation that curbed tobacco marketing. The Marlboro Man, Joe Camel, the Salem couple, all that seductive stuff. And it took a long time to get all that done. But truthfully, it was almost like a labor of love. Fighting that fight was really worthwhile.
I bet it was. I can just, if you look at any of the old films nowadays, everyone is smoking. Smoking is just what people did. My mother smoked. We would go to bed every night, Bill, saying to my mother, "Good night, Mom. Stop smoking." You know? And, you know, she was, you know, she didn't stop smoking until she was about 60 years old. As you say, it takes a lot of time. But just imagine living in an environment, and our young people today don't live in that same environment, thanks to you and others, but in an environment where smoking was just pervasive. It was just everywhere you went, and no one thought it was a problem. We'd go into an office and people would be smoking, and you'd go into a restroom, people would be smoking. You go on an airplane. My wife worked many years in the airline industry as a flight attendant, and people don't realize that there were smoking sections on an airplane. Imagine what that's like, right?
So
it was everywhere. And to create an environment, a new environment where people thought differently about smoking, I have to tell you, that must be one of your greatest accomplishments, Bill. So you should feel really good about that. And it's also, in my mind, an example to others listening who are fighting a good fight of some type now, that with good strategy and good people, you can accomplish that. What would you say, Bill, were the keys to success? I mean, you mentioned the four areas that you focused on, but if you were promoting the ending or the creation of anything new that was good, what might be some of the elements, if you could think of them, that people might want to consider?
Well, I think you named some of them, Art. First of all, you remember back in those days, smoking was normal, right? I mean, it was normative behavior. Mm-hmm. Just as you said, airplanes, offices, restaurants, you name it. And what we had to do really was change social norms. We had to get it so that smoking was not normal and that it was something that you didn't need to do or didn't even want to do. And in my mind, the quickest ways to do that, I'm not saying it's quick at all, but the fastest ways to do it are policy change and the media and also technology. So we worked in all those areas. But if we can change policy, if we can say, okay, you can't smoke in public places, you know, that can make a huge difference. And look, Art, today at obesity. I mean, this is a terrible problem that we have. A third of the American population is obese and another third is overweight. And I'm doing some work now, and I talk about it in the book. I'm doing some work now in that area. And so the big challenge for us, Art, is how do we make obesity not normative? When you have that many people at that level, it makes it hard to change.
Yeah, it certainly does. So we jump from tobacco wars, where you obviously, as you say, took some punches for that one. But it's not about who wins the round, right? It's about who wins the whole battle. And it looks like we definitely won, although there's always work to be done on that front. But you clearly drove us forward there. And so you declare victory and suddenly you're at AARP. And what did you find when you got there and where were you able to drive it?
Before we get to AARP, I just want to say, in terms of saying we won the war, You know, Art, we can never let our guard down.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
I mean, no matter what it is, no matter what kind of social change we've achieved, you got to be careful. So today, smoking is way down among adults and kids, but vaping is up. And so we've got to be focused on that. It's a good example of saying, you know, you never declare victory.
Yeah, great point. You got me thinking now, because I want to make another point with you. When we talk about impact nowadays, I don't think people truly understand what it takes to create impact. Sure, you can be lucky and do one thing and it, you know, opens a whole door to change. But usually it's going to take a lot of concerted effort by a lot of people over a long period of time. And sometimes when I hear people talk about impact, I don't think they really give the word justice. You know, they're talking about, oh, I made a donation, you know, I got impact, or I walked in a protest, I created impact. Sure, those things help.
Yeah.
But true impact is based on the kind of work that you did and others over a long period of time. And I just want to make sure people understand that, because frankly, I think that a lot of people get disoriented when they see the nature of the challenge, Bill. And when they take those two or three punches, they're ready to sort of quit and move on to something else. And it, of course, takes this concerted effort that you and so many others put in to make it happen. What's your thought about that?
Yeah, I truly and truly agree with that, Art. If you take something as big and as bad, and I'll even say as evil as the tobacco industry, you say, well, how can we prevail against that? But the truth is, we can move mountains. If we work together, and as you say, if we stay at it, if we don't quit, if we have the courage of our convictions, we can really make change.
All right, so AARP.
Yeah, AARP. When I got to AARP, I got a phone call from a reporter. And she said, are you going to attack the pharmaceutical industry like you've been attacking the tobacco industry? And I said, absolutely not. I said, you know, the tobacco industry kills people and the pharmaceutical industry saves lives. But pharmaceutical prices are too high in this country and people cannot afford their medication. And we've got to do something about that. So I was there for a very short time, and all of a sudden, I'm in a new fight. And the fight was to get prescription drugs into Medicare. And in that battle, you had the Republicans at the time deciding that they wanted to do this, and the Democrats, for their own reasons, opposing it. And we actually won. I mean, AARP was instrumental in getting prescription drugs into Medicare.
Okay, so you have to, wait a minute, you have to explain to me, because in the context of today's world, you sort of see that flipped around where the Democrats would support getting it into you know? So how, wait a minute, what was the context that was driving, you know, sort of that view of the world?
Well, this might sound a touch cynical to you and your listeners, but really it was the era of George W. Bush. And the Republicans had the idea that if they could do this, that they would win older voters for the next generation. And the Democrats, if I may say so, were basically saying, hey, Medicare is our program. We don't want these Republicans to have a win.
Wow.
And so it was that kind of thing, just as we see it today, Art, just as we see it today. And then after we got that done, then the George W. Bush said, okay, now I'm going to partially privatize Social Security. And we said, no, that's not what Social Security should be, and we're not going to let that happen. So now we're fighting the Republicans and working with the Democrats. And the lesson learned here is, you know, that there are no permanent enemies, no permanent opponents, just permanent values and principles. You got to call them as you see them.
I'm going to have to use that quote in your promo for this podcast. I think that is dead on and great advice. Wow. So we were able to get this really important element put into our legislation so that now people can afford to access their medications. That's another life-saving enterprise you orchestrated.
Well, I take a lot of pride in that one. And just like tobacco, I've got the scars to prove it.
So tell me about one of those scars.
Well, the Republicans called me a Democrat, and they meant that in the worst way possible. The Democrats called me a Republican. One senator called me a communist.
My goodness.
You know, I am basically a guy who believes in capitalism. I believe in the American way. And I thought to myself, those are just badges of honor. Those don't hurt me. And I'm where I've always been, which is in the middle. I think of myself, and I tried to steer AARP into what I call the pragmatic center.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a plaque on my wall, Art, that I would see every morning when I got into work. And it had a quote by a prominent Republican, Senator Trent Lott, saying that AARP was a wholly owned subsidiary of the Democratic Party.
Wow.
And another quote right under it by Pete Stark, who is a very liberal Democrat from California. And he said, what does AARP stand for? Always advocating for the Republican Party. And every morning I would see that and I'd say, yep, right down the middle.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I guess you succeeded in, you know, helping people appreciate you were, you know, about principles and about issues more so than you were about parties. And it's certainly an important lesson for us to appreciate and understand, although we will get those scars, weren't we? But maybe those are scars of honor to some extent.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, Bill, you also, and I want to talk about your book too, but I want to talk about your transition to teaching and your obvious love for academia and education and students. How did you end up at Georgetown, and what drove you in the direction of Georgetown?
Well, I always wanted to have an academic chapter in my career.
Mm-hmm.
And one day a guy from the Washington Post said to me, well, you've been here at AARP a while. What's next? And I said to him, well, I'm going to go to a great university with a really good gym, and I'm going to audit anthropology courses and drink beer with the students.
Wow.
And, of course, I meant it, you know, in a kind of a jocular way, but he printed it exactly as I said it. So I luckily connected up with the then dean of the business school at Georgetown, and we hit it off, and I ended up there in the business school. And I'm not drinking beer with students, and I don't have time to audit anthropology courses. But
no,
it's a great university, and you know, Art, you've addressed the MBA students in my classes there, and you know that tomorrow's leaders are right there in those classrooms.
I always look forward to coming to your class and speaking to those students. It just lifts my week when I know it's my week to go in and talk to these really bright and enterprising young people about the nonprofit sector. And I'm always grateful that you invite me to come in. They teach me a lot too. Bill, I don't know if you know, but I teach a course at Columbia University in the School of Professional Studies there in ethics in the nonprofit sector to their Masters of Nonprofit Management students. And it is a joy to have the opportunity to spend time with them. And I'm sure you've seen that many times over at Georgetown as well.
Yeah, I think it's right. You know, I really applaud what you're doing there. It's really interesting about ethics, Art. I'd love to hear your thought on this. What I always try to say to students is ethics has to permeate everything, not just a separate course. I mean, we need to be teaching ethics in accounting, in marketing, in finance, in supply chains. I mean, when you get up in the morning, you've got to be ethical.
You're absolutely right. The way we approach it is we go through many of the issues that people will experience in doing nonprofit work, whether that be fundraising, managing finances, or marketing and communications, you know, developing programs. And in every instance, there are ethical issues that come up that students need tools to help them address. And So we try to give them tools that they can use to be effective and ethical people in their work. But it does also permeate your lifestyle. Many of the students will tell me that, you know, we use these tools in our lives. You know, we had a conversation with a spouse or a friend about something that they were planning to do, and we used these tools to decide what the best outcome would be from an ethical standpoint. So
yeah,
it does permeate your life. You're absolutely right. So
yeah. Art, I wonder if you've seen what I've seen with these students. You know, more and more and more, they want something more than a paycheck.
Sure.
And they often say, I want purpose. I need to go out and make a living. I need to pay off my student debts. I want to have a family, etc. But I don't want to lose my sense of purpose.
That's absolutely right. And so, you know, what we are trying to do with this podcast, Bill, is help young people understand that wherever they are in their lives, which is why this interview with you was so important for them to hear, wherever you are in your life, you can inject giving back. In your case, you were in business for many years and you found a way to give back while you were in business. When you left business, you found obvious ways to give back. And so we want them to understand, you know, it doesn't matter if you're in a career serving the nonprofit sector, wherever you are, there's something that you can contribute to society to make it better. And Bill, I think you would agree, our country depends on it.
I agree 100%, Art. You know, we have the country we have because people are so generous and they care about each other. You know, it's one thing to say, well, I'm just going to worry about my family. I mean, very few people are so narrowly focused. Most people in this country are really generous. And, you know, here we are in the midst of a coronavirus. You know, these are tough times. And a lot of nonprofits have had to pull back. You know, I'm on the boards and work with a number of nonprofits, and they've had to pull back, but so have companies. And they're all basically saying, we're going to come out of this okay. And when we do, we want to have a better organization and we want to have a better country. And it just puts a song in my heart.
Yeah. So, Bill, you created over at Georgetown a center. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a center that's dedicated to the kinds of things we're talking about. So we do partnerships with nonprofit organizations, with companies, and with government agencies. And the idea is to think about the triple bottom line, you know, people, planet, profit. Another way to think about it is doing well by doing good. So a lot of these big companies, they've come to realize that they can create economic value for their stockholders by creating social value for the rest of us. And there are some really nice examples of that. And so more and more companies are figuring this out. And we have about 150 students involved in this.
Wow.
Many of them are from our business school, but also from other schools around the university. And this concept of not just giving back, but, you know, making a difference is a powerful magnet for students and prospective students. So despite, you know, the tough times that we're facing right now, this Business for Impact program we have is really going well.
So tell me how this ties into your new book, Good Business.
Well, the name of the book is Good Business, The Talk, Fight, Win Way to Change the World. And it's what you and I have been talking about. The idea is that, you know, these big social and environmental issues, they're way too tough for any one sector to solve. We've got to come together, everybody at the table. So, you know, there are a lot of companies who don't want to deal with nonprofits and a lot of nonprofits who say, well, they're the bad guys. And I say, no, we've got to get everybody at the table. As we were saying before, you know, Tuesday's opponent can be Thursday's ally. And so that's what we try to do. And when I was talking about obesity before, we have a big program called the Portion Balance Coalition. And it's got food companies, beverage companies, government, academics, nonprofits, all working together to try to deal with overweight and obesity. And it's not easy to get all these people to sit down together, but that's what we've got to do.
And does your book outline some ways for people to think about winning these bigger contests or these bigger sort of challenges that we face in our world to get better and to help people thrive?
Yeah, it does. It does that, Art. And also what I talk about is that no matter where you are in whatever organization or whatever stage of your career, you can make a difference. Just the thing you were talking about earlier. You know, we can all make a dent in the universe. And I talk about different people in the book who have done that, including Nancy Brown as an example, different students who are engaged in that. I talk about, for example, a program that I work on called the Coalition to Transform Advanced Care. And this is about people with advanced illness who need some help. And what can we do about this? What can we do about people who have multiple chronic diseases? Curative care is not working so well. How can we help them? So I give many examples in the book and talk about many, I'm going to call them heroes, you know, people who are doing the things that you and I like to think about and talk about and do. And of course, nonprofits are so important. I mean, it's such a key part of our society, as well as companies and as well as government.
Well, you know, it's so important for nonprofit leaders to understand that we're no longer the sole province of social good. As you pointed out, companies are coming to realize that in order to succeed financially and to return profits to their shareholders, they need to be mindful of social change and to make sure that's part of how they go about doing their work. Many people will tell me that if we're going to succeed in changing our poor environmentally protective habits, that somehow we have to find a way to help businesses appreciate there's economic benefit for them to do so. And I think people are really working toward that. Even on the business of diversity, equity, and inclusion, we're finding that companies are realizing that it's not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do to make sure that your employee base, your contractors, your suppliers, your leaders all represent the diversity of the country, makes your business stronger. And a stronger business obviously leads to better performance and higher profits. So this is indeed an important set of themes that you're taking on in this book, Good Business, because it in fact will not only make these companies more profitable, but it will also help us move the world forward.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I'm seeing this everywhere. It's companies, it's nonprofits, it's universities. Everybody wants to try to do something about diversity and equity. I think it's remarkable. And I think your job, my job, everybody's job is to make sure that that keeps going, that that generates momentum. And from a business school, you know, we say to ourselves, how can we help get more diversity into the boardroom? How can we help get more diversity into the workplace? And so we're working on this, but we are certainly not alone. It's remarkable to see how this is taking off.
Yeah, and that's so important that the boardrooms diversify. Bill, a few weeks ago, I wrote an article that appeared in Forbes magazine about the need to diversify foundation boards, where we find that in a survey that was done back in 2017 of 111 foundations that responded, 40% of them had 100% white boards. We give these organizations special tax advantage, and yet a diverse country is sort of supporting them through tax exemption, but they won't share the ability to make decisions with that diverse set of stakeholders in our country. So we have some work to do, obviously, but calling it out and helping people see the value in it, I think, will ultimately get us there. And it's so great that you have this book out that is helping us think about how to talk, fight, win, and change the world at the same time. It's called Good Business, the Talk, Fight, Win Way to Change the World by Bill Novelli. So we're going to wait for that to come out in February. And Bill, obviously, you know, we'll continue to talk about that and other things that you're doing. I've always appreciated, you know, our friendship and this great work that you've done throughout your life. You've been a a role model of sorts for me, and I know for many others as well. You know, I want to thank you for joining me on a podcast.
Well, Art, I want to thank you for having me, but even more than that, I want to thank you for your good work. You know, you are a champion of what you call a giving society. And there's nothing more important than that to keep America good and strong and great.
Well, thank you, Bill. This is the Heart of Giving podcast. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and I've been with Bill Novelli. I hope you'll join us for our next episode. And you can find this podcast on all major podcast platforms. Thank you for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.